Hello. So I'm one of the last three obstacles between you and the booze. I'm fighting a cold, so I may space out and say lovely otters to distract you. Fantastic term. I too am a professor. I teach right here in New York at a place called City College. I am from the chemical engineering department. My background is in material science. I'm going to be talking about a different aspect of open source hardware, or open hardware. I don't know what this is called. So I do batteries, and batteries are on the precipice of electricity and chemistry. So we call ourselves electrochemists. So the question is, why is this so hard? Right? Why is charging a battery so hard? You can buy a battery charger from Apple or from your cell phone manufacturer for between $30 and $50, and you can find the same thing on eBay for $3, right? So it's not. And everyone, up to about 30 years ago, used to make their own devices called potentiostatic galvanostats. And what a potentiostatic galvanostat does is allow you to very carefully control the charging parameters. And the charging parameters have enormous effects on the properties of the battery. So all you have to know is that the battery is made up of some materials. The materials undergo massive change during charge and discharge. And the way you charge it is crucial to the future behavior of the battery. Now, everyone used to make their own, and there were differences in the designs, so people would go to conferences and argue that, well, your result isn't correct because you didn't use the blah, blah, blah circuit. So companies formed to streamline and standardize these units, and that was good, except for the fact that over the years people forgot how to make their own, or rather the institutional knowledge wasn't passed on. And there's an interesting dividing line. You can sort of look at about, I'm going to make up a number, 1983, And that particular professor knew how to make his or her own galvanostat, potentiostat. Their students probably didn't. If you have beers with the curmudgeonly old professors, they will prattle on about this and on and on. So this is what the commercial devices look like. They're nothing special. They just look like big battery chargers, and they're enormously expensive. You think, geez, how much more carefully do I need to throttle the electrons such that I can really understand the properties. So the cheapest, and this is in a multi-channel unit, so it's $1,000 a channel, but you have to buy 10 channels. And so the top two units are standard battery chargers. They don't really do anything other than what your plug-in battery charger does, other than really carefully throttle and allow you to discharge. You get into a slightly fancier unit in the Gamery. And then you get the Princeton Applied Research and the Autolab, and these are sort of the kings of battery research. You can do more complicated experiments. Now, these devices are extremely good at what they're designed to do. And they're sold by very nice folks that are knowledgeable, and they can abstract the internal functionality. So now my students and chemists and material scientists don't have to worry about the electrons. They don't have to worry about what the circuit does. But this becomes a problem because you can do so many interesting things with the electrons. You can do so many interesting things with the circuits, and our students outside of EECS aren't learning this anymore. We hack matter and circuits and things that start with GNU and things that look like GCC are feared by my students. I think that's a fair statement, all except for a rare few who really should be in EECS and don't know it. And I don't tell them because I need them around. So to pull a line from Fight Club, the things you own end up owning you. And this has been repeated a few times today, but it's critical because the abstraction, the cost, and the inflexibility of these devices define the experiment. You can't do everything with electricity anymore. You can only do what this box tells you to do. And this box has very few coded experiments. And you can alter this property and that property. But it's incredibly hard to hack. Forget about a serial interface. Forget about RS-232. They stopped putting that in about 15, 20 years ago. So our students then become defined by what these boxes can do. And they don't think that the real control they have is partially in what they're doing with the electrons. They can think about matter in the most wonderful and beautiful ways, but the fact that the electrons control the configuration of the matter becomes more and more of an abstraction, which it really shouldn't be. So the experiment the experimentalist needs to have access to tools that allow her to define the experiment. This needs to be brought back into the picture. Now, the problem is that as engineering has become a very segmented field, because there's so much more to learn now than there was 50 years ago when those old curmudgeonly professors were designing their own potential stack galvanostats, you say time's too short. How am I supposed to learn all about material and matter and everything that's been created in the past 50 years and still learn all of this programming crap? And circuit engineering is just seen like there's some eeks guy, he's going to figure it out, and that's going to be the end of it. So as a grad student, I wasn't thinking about any of this. I just needed one of these things. Mine broke. I was on fellowship, and my particular project had no money, so I had to come up with my own thing. So I was hacking around with an Arduino, and before that, because I'm a little more computer inclined, I learned a little bit about Atmels, and the Arduino made it so much easier. So I built a potentiostatic galvanostat based on this. And we've been using it. Now that I'm a professor, my students begin to use it in the lab, and I've spread it out to a few universities. I mean, it was really a sort of a beer money effort. When I was a grad student, and again, now I'm a professor, I can't really sell these things and use them in my lab and have students do research on them without running into some massive conflicts of interest. I think MIT is a little more strict and has more oversight than City College does, but you really do have to be careful. So what is it? Well, you know, it looks like an Arduino with a shield on top. It's all three-hole. Anyone can build it. And the thought was that I would put it online, and it was conversations with Limor Frieda a few years ago that really encouraged me to put it online and let people do whatever they wanted to do with it. So this is an old version, but I particularly like this picture because it shows what a simple device it is, all through hole. I made socket mounts so that things wouldn't blow up. Or if they blew up, I can swap them out easily enough. Now, it's not nearly as good as those expensive devices. It doesn't have the resolution or the full feature set, but it costs, you know, effectively two orders of magnitude less. And you can do whatever you want with it. So I'm going to say cost and hackability are key. If Budweiser can put drinkability on a bottle for 100 years, I can say hackability. So I'm going to give you three reasons why this is important. Screening, training, and defining. In batteries, there are a lot of parameters you can change internally, and then how you treat it with the electrons. So you can design a massive design of experiments. And battery models suck, so you really do have to test every parameter and see what's first order and what's second order. So I can, if I scale it up, I can build 20 Arduostats for my lab for $1,000 and have a student go nuts on that, and that $1,000 fits neatly within even the smallest grant. So even if I need to make completely new units because the other student poured acid on the other ones, which does happen, this is a battery lab, it's not a huge cost. So we can test them for longer, and we can run many cycles. Because those units cost so much, you run 10 cycles on them and you're on to the next thing. But now people want batteries that last 5,000 cycles, and you can't just speed them up. You can't just say, well, I'm going to charge it faster or slower. Again, that radically affects the materials. So you have to let them sit around. So this thing costs $50. You plug it into a USB port and you leave it for a few months. The other thing it allows is you don't have to worry about students breaking your precious $15,000 device. These are two students. The fellow on the left, your left, it was a high school student who was using it for one of those fancy Intel fellowships. He was a semi-finalist. He's at Hopkins now. The fellow on the right, Michael Henry, did this for a senior design class, and he's doing Teach for America now. This allowed them to have experiences that they wouldn't ordinarily have. Most people don't let the undergraduates touch the galvanostat potentiostat because there are only one or two in a lab, and they're just absolutely critical. So it allows students to touch chemical reactors that are much, much cheaper and easier to use, frankly. And finally, this is what I want to alert folks out there that are making open source hardware, open hardware. what really needs to happen in this area, and I think this is a good case for a lot of other areas of engineering that aren't necessarily electrical or computer related, more of the physical material sciences, is you need to have in situ experiments. You need to mix signals and have very strict time bases, and you might want to change what the pulsing behavior looks like. And it's a big market. It's not a huge market, but it's the companies that make a living off of this, and they sell things that are just fancy battery chargers for $15,000, right? So, you know, if you can design an AC adapter and you can put a little bit of markup on it, you can charge $500 for it, make a lot of beer money, probably start a company off of it, and have the eternal love of the academy. This is an experiment we're running where we're looking at the inside of a battery and running it back and forth, and we run a baseline experiment with a fancy piece of equipment to make sure the aerostat's behaving correctly, but it's really hard to time sync it. So if we want to put computer vision into this experiment and have the current back off when we see material breaking, it's almost impossible to do that with even the $15,000 device. So some people might say, well, why not LabVIEW? And LabVIEW allows modification, allows you to build circuits. But what I've seen, and this is only anecdotal knowledge, is that folks learned in LabVIEW don't really want to do anything else, and they don't think about sort of scaling their products. And the coding environment sucks, so it's not really. I don't think engineers should be learning LabVIEW. I'm sick of it. So when the Arduino does what that $200 LabVIEW box does for like $25, and it's an infinitely more robust language, it just makes a lot of sense. I couldn't convince the chair of my department this time around, but hopefully when I'm tenured, I'll be able to do it myself, and we'll figure it out. So just to wrap up, for this area of engineering, these people don't want to see a terminal. They don't want to see GCC. They want a tool set that's easy to use. Bruce Perrin's point about like understanding your user and that how people might not want to see the terminals is really important, because they're doing very important things. They're making batteries that can back up New York City or something like that. And it shouldn't be LabVIEW, because this should be scalable. This should be something that they can repeat again and again and again, and modify in any way they want. Now, the Arduino is a great start, but it would be better if it had, you know, 14 or 16-bit DACs and ADCs rather than just a PWM and 10-bit ADCs. So I sort of throw out the idea for those interested of a SiDuino, a unit based on the Arduino with that's just as easy to use with better resolution, and the idea of stealing from bug labs a little bit of modules. So you plug in a thermocouple module, or you plug in a pH meter. And I know there's some companies, there's a company called Vernier that's going in the right direction, but it's not as stackable and hackable as it ought to be for these types of in situ experiments. That tool is great for training labs, but it's not really good for PhD students. So I invite you to think about this, and I thank you for your time. Lovely otters. Any questions?
Name of that company again?
In Vernier?
Yeah, just one you just mentioned.
Yeah, Vernier. They're based out of Texas. They're very nice. I mean, they sell cool units with pretty nice software, and they're very low cost, and they have like every environmental sensor imaginable.
Thank you.